Now, I want to tell you that I consider it a special trust that you have assigned me the topic for this hour. It is a topic that does indeed need to be simple because everyone needs to understand it. We know that we must follow God's moral law for our lives. And we know that an essential part of God's moral law is God's sexual moral law. If we are uncertain about the line between marriage and non-marriage, if we're uncertain about where God has drawn the line for marriage, then we're uncertain about the line God has drawn for morality and immorality, because it is the same line. Those intimacies that are moral within marriage are immoral outside of marriage. If we are uncertain about where God has drawn the line for marriage, then we are uncertain about the line between morality and immorality, because it is the same line. So I have taken very seriously the charge to speak with simplicity about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. In fact, some of the things I say this morning may be expressed in terms that are simpler than you've heard them expressed before. I believe that to properly understand Jesus' teachings, we may need, in some cases, to take off our glasses of 21st century culture to see these teachings in their original simplicity of their setting. And I know that is very difficult for us to do. But let me just ask you to please consider the things that I have to say this morning, and then, of course, study the Scriptures to see if, in fact, they are not, in fact, the simple teaching that Jesus is giving us here. There are outlines that are available on page 20 of the booklet that you have, and let me just suggest, if you didn't pick up a booklet when you came into the auditorium this morning, you may want to take a moment just to go back and get a copy of that. I provided a little bit longer than usual outline, because there are a number of things that I'm going to try to say in the few minutes that I've been allotted. You will see from that outline that I believe to see Jesus teaching in Matthew 19:19 best, what we need to do is just to follow the context of the discussion that leads up to it. In verses 1 through 6, or especially verses 3 through 6, we need to reconnect Jesus' words with the original context of Genesis 2, because that's what he's referring to. In the last part of verse 6, we need to reconcile Jesus' words with the language of Paul in 1 Corinthians 7. In verses 7 and 8, we need to recognize the proper place for civil law. And then I believe we will be able to reduce Jesus' words in Matthew 19:9 to simple English terms. So first, I believe simplicity requires reconnecting Jesus' words with the context of Genesis chapter 2. Let us begin by looking at Matthew chapter 19, verse 3. The motivation for Jesus' discussion on the topic of divorce and remarriage was a question by the Pharisees. Matthew 19, verse 3, the Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him, and saying unto him, "Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause?" And he answered and he said unto them, "Have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female? And he said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder." And Jesus responds to those Pharisees' questions. Jesus refers first to the passage in Genesis chapter 2. For that physical joining between the man and the woman was initiated by God. Jesus speaks of God creating a man and a woman. He mentions the man cleaving to his wife and the two becoming one flesh. Here Jesus echoes the language of Genesis chapter 2 verse 24. And Genesis 2:24 says, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." Well, in Ephesians 5:21, Paul echoes that same language also. Ephesians 5:21 says, "For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh." Well, what does it mean when it talks about a man and a woman being joined? What does it mean when it talks about them being joined into one flesh? It's talking about them being sexually united. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 16, I believe this is unmistakably clear. In 1 Corinthians 6:16, Paul talks about a physical joining. And he uses, again, he echoes some of that same Genesis language. 1 Corinthians 6:16, Paul says, "What? Know ye not that he which is joined to an harlot is one body? For two," here's this Genesis language echoed again, "for two, saith he, shall be one flesh." One flesh refers to the sexual joining that God instituted between a man and a woman. Now, in 1 Corinthians 6:16, that joining is there, and that's actually, the joining is a form of the same Greek word that Jesus uses in Matthew 19, which is usually translated there as cleaving. Now, I know in our minds, when we talk about a man leaving his father and mother and cleaving to his wife, we have a much broader picture. We see the young couple there, hand in hand, clinging to one another in their new marriage cottage. But that word cleaving is a word that refers to the sexual union. The word cleaving that Jesus uses in Matthew 19:9 is a form of the same Greek word that Paul uses here in 1 Corinthians 6:16, where he talks about a man being joined to a harlot. And we know that's not marriage. Same form, the forms of the same Greek word in Matthew 19, verse 5, Ephesians 5, 31, 1 Corinthians 6:16. A sexual union, that is the joining, that is the cleaving that Jesus is talking about in Matthew 19. Now we know from these verses and other verses in the Scriptures that sexual union alone does not make a marriage. And we know that God intends for a marriage to be much more than a sexual union. We know there are emotional parts that are marriage that are extremely important. We know there's to be love. There's supposed to be caring. There's to be respect. And we know that legally there is more to a marriage. We know that the laws of the land must be considered. But in Genesis 2, there was no law of the land. There was not the legal joining that we think of in terms of civil laws today. Those emotional aspects of marriage, those legal aspects of marriage are important, but they are found in other passages. We need to go to those other passages to study those topics and to study those topics in their context in those other passages. When we bring those ideas of the emotions and the legalities or even the cultural implications as we see marriage in these times or as we try to see marriage in the first century, when we bring those ideas to this discussion in Matthew 19, we're engaging in eisegesis. We're bringing those ideas with us and imposing them on this passage. What I'm trying to encourage us to do is to do exegesis. And that is, look at just the things that Jesus is saying in this passage. And to draw our understanding of Jesus' words from the things that he actually says here. With his reference to Genesis 2, Jesus is referring only to the physical joining between the man that God had made and the woman that God had made for that man. And then Jesus quickly adds that this one flesh relationship was not to be disrupted. Matthew 19:6, he says, "There, what therefore God has joined together, let not man put asunder." The joining, the sexual union that God instituted between these two people was not to be disrupted. So in his opening remarks with these Pharisees, Jesus takes this discussion first back to a simple time. He takes them back to Genesis 2 to a simple, uncomplicated time. And we may need to take off our 21st century cultural glasses to really see the simplicity of what Jesus is talking about. He is not making a statement about customs, social customs, and he is not making a statement about civil legalities. He's making a simple statement about a simple principle. The simple principle is this, that when God brought the woman to the man, he joined them in a physical one-flesh union, a union that was not to be disrupted. Point number two, simplicity next requires reconciling Jesus' words with the language of 1 Corinthians 7, Paul's language there. And by using the word reconciling, I'm not suggesting they're contradictory. I'm saying we're going to see the consistency. And we can see some additional insights into what Jesus is saying by the similarity of the language. The language of Jesus in Matthew 19 has many links to Paul's discussion in 1 Corinthians 7. And one of these links is a similarity of vocabulary. In Matthew 19:6, when Jesus says, "What God has joined together, let not man put asunder." The expression "put asunder" in Matthew 19:6 is a form of the Greek word chorizo. Well, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul also uses a form of that Greek word chorizo. In 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 and 11, the word that our English translators there put as "depart" is a form of the same word chorizo that Jesus uses in Matthew 19. In 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 and 11, Paul says, "Let not the wife depart." That's that word chorizo. "Let not the wife depart from her husband, but and if she depart," chorizo, "let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband." The first thing that we want to see from comparing Jesus' discussion in Matthew 19 with Paul's discussion in 1 Corinthians 7 is a simple, practical understanding of what Jesus means when he says, "put asunder," when he uses that word chorizo. According to Lowe and Nita, in their Greek-English lexicon of the New Testament based on semantic domains, chorizo means to separate, often by some intervening distance, to separate, to set one apart from another. When you enforce space between, when you put room between, when you enforce a separation distance between a man and a woman, you have chorizoed, you have put asunder, you have defeated the physical union that they are supposed to have. And that is exactly the circumstance that Paul describes in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where he uses a form of that word chorizo. In verse 10, Paul says that a wife should not be chorizoed from her husband. The actual Greek word is not an active voice verb. It's a passive voice verb. It's the aorist passive infinitive. It means, in the language of the McReynolds interlinear, that the woman must not be separated from the man. You hear that passive voice? She must not be separated from the man. This is strong language. This is stronger language than just saying she must not depart, which sounds active voice. What Paul is saying here, let them not be separated. Let them not be separated by anything that would bring that distance between them. So both Jesus in Matthew 19 and Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 are saying that the physical union between the man and the woman should not be chorizoed. It should not be put asunder. No man should put a distance between the two people who are supposed to be physically joined and thereby defeat the physical union God intended for them to have. Now, the second thing we want to look at in comparing Matthew 19 with 1 Corinthians 7 is, and this is closely related, we want to note that the union between the man and the woman can, in fact, be disrupted. When some read in Matthew 19:6 that Jesus says, "Let not man put asunder," they say that means that man cannot. Man cannot put that relationship asunder. They would say that man cannot, to use the Greek word, man cannot chorizo the union. But look in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. In his discussion in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul clearly contemplates a situation in which the putting asunder, the chorizoing, if you will, has in fact occurred. Paul, in fact, is revealing what the choices are when the relationship has been put asunder, when it has been chorizoed. The choices are, let her remain without a partner, or let her be reconciled to the man. Here, using the form of the same word that Jesus uses, Paul shows that the chorizoing, the putting asunder of the union, is a very real possibility, not an impossibility. There's one other thing I'd like for us to note about the last part of verse 11. The last part of 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 11. Paul says, "But and if she depart, let her remain unmarried, or let her be reconciled to her husband." Now, is this contradictory language in the Scripture? When Paul talks about a woman that's unmarried, And in the same breath, he talks about her being reconciled to her husband. No, this is not contradictory language. This is using language exactly the same way that we use language today. Today, I might say that I will bury my wife in a cemetery near her hometown. Well, at a future hypothetical time after she is dead, she is technically no longer my wife. But I refer to her as my wife by way of identification, because that's what she is right now while I'm making the statement. I will bury at some future time the one who is right now my wife. And the scripture uses this kind of language in a similar way. Acts chapter 5, verse 10. In Acts chapter 5, after Ananias and Sapphira have both come in and both have lied and both have died, Luke tells us in Acts 5:10 that the young men came in and found her dead, and carrying her forth, buried her by her husband. Well, he was already dead. Technically, he wasn't her husband, but he is referred to as such by way of identification. And that's the way that Paul uses language in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 11. In his discussion there, Paul refers to a future hypothetical situation in which a woman may depart. She may depart. The Greek verb there is in the subjunctive. She may depart, thereby disrupting, charizoing the union, and becoming unmarried. But in that future unmarried state, she has two options. One is she can remain unmarried because that's what she's going to be in that future hypothetical state. Or her other choice is to be reconciled. Reconciled to whom? Well, the person who is still right now, while Paul is writing this sentence, still her husband. Just as we would say at some future time after she is dead, a man will bury the woman who is right now his wife, Paul says that at some future time after she is unmarried, a woman could be reconciled to the man who is still right now her husband. This is the common, ordinary, simple way that we use language today. The New Testament uses the language the same way. So Paul's statement in 1 Corinthians 7 helps make it clear that one can indeed charizo, one can put away a union by putting a distance between the man and the woman. Now, in our next point, simplicity. Simplicity next requires recognizing the role of civil law. As we continue to follow in order Jesus' discussion in Matthew chapter 19, Jesus is next asked in verses 7 and 8, why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement and put her away? He, Jesus, said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you to put away your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. First, I would like to just simply note in this passage that two different distinctive things are mentioned. A writing of divorcement and a putting away. Let us first, for a few minutes, discuss the putting away. Those two words in our English translation, putting away, are a translation of a single Greek word, apoluo. What does the word apoluo mean? Well, literally, the word apoluo means to put away from. One thing I believe that should be clear is that apoluo is not a technical Greek word for divorce. One reason that we can see it's not the technical Greek word for divorce is the wide variety of applications that it's given in the New Testament. Lo and Nita in their lexicon tell us that the word has a highly generic meaning applicable to a wide variety of circumstances. Of the 100+ times that this word apoluo is used in the Greek New Testament, the American Standard Version translators never, never translate it as divorce. The King James translators translate it divorce only once in Matthew 5:32, and even there they do it inconsistently. The word apoluo occurs twice in Matthew 5:32, and in the first part, the King James translators translate it as put away, and the last part of the verse they translate it as divorce, even though the same Greek word is used and the same action is clearly meant. Now, you're going to find apoluo translated divorce in many, if not most, of the more modern translations. When modern translators render it divorce, they are retrofitting an English legal term according to their understanding. I would suggest to you their misunderstanding of the context of this passage. These modern translators make apoluo seem like a legal action because they pick a legal term to translate it. To understand the simplicity of what Jesus is saying here, we may need to not only take off our glasses of 21st century culture, we may also need to take off the cultural glasses of those who provide some of the translations that are available today. We can see from its many and its varied uses that apoluo is not the Greek legal term for divorce. It is a word that means to put away from. Now, I believe there's another reason that we can see that apoluo is not the Greek legal term for divorce, and that is that in these verses we have the Greek legal term for divorce. Note the distinctions made in Matthew 19, verse 7. There is the writing of divorcement, and then there is this putting away, this apoluoing. Now, this phrase writing of divorcement or bill of divorcement is found only three times in the New Testament. Matthew 5:31, Matthew 19:7, and Mark 10:4. Every time this phrase is found in the New Testament, it is translated in terms of this writing or bill of divorcement. It's translated divorcement, and the context makes it clear that it's talking about the written work. It calls it the writing or the bill of divorcement. I believe we need to recall that Moses was not only the religious leader of the nation of Israel, but he was also their civil administrator. Here is a reference to his issuance of a writing that was documented what was occurring, that is the apoluoing, the putting away. Note the language in Matthew 5:31. Matthew 5:31 says, "It hath been said, whoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement." People were putting away their wives in the times of Moses. There was just no stopping them. Men were putting the women out of the house, or they were abandoning the women. Those who were putting away their spouses were instructed, if you will, put it in writing. But we must not confuse Moses' administrative actions with God's legislative actions. It would be a mistake to conclude that God or Moses was approving the dissolutions of those marriages just because Moses was keeping a written record of who was doing it. And evidently that was exactly the mistake. Evidently that was exactly the wrong conclusion that many Jews in Jesus' day were drawing. How do I know that? Well, I think that's the case because in Matthew chapter 5, we see Jesus taking a whole series of the Jews' misrepresentations of the law of Moses. And he just goes down the list, correcting them one at a time. And one of those in Matthew 5:31 and 32 was the erroneous interpretation that the recognition in writing somehow implied God's approval. Now, it's true God's servant Moses wrote that precept. If you look at Mark chapter 10, verse 5, he was recognizing with a legal document what the people were doing. But if you look at that word suffer, it says Moses suffered. That word suffered seems in the way that it's used to imply more an indulgence than it does approval. I think we would say that God indulged David to have many, many wives. He didn't strike David dead. He didn't strike all the wives dead. But because God indulged David in having his many wives, who would try to look at that and say that therefore God has approved of polygamy for all times? Sometimes God recognizes those things of which he does not approve. God recognizes sinful actions even though he does not approve of them. You might look to Ezra chapter 10 for another example. God had prohibited his people from intermarrying with the nations around there. They did it. Ezra chapter 10, verse 10, God's prophet calls those people wives. There's a recognition, even of relationships of which God did not approve. Moses was recognizing that the people were, in fact, putting away wives, and he was keeping written records. But recognition does not imply God's approval. The Jews have been claiming that because Moses indulged the putting away and issued a writing of divorcement, that somehow God was approving of such putting aways. But Jesus' words on that theory are abundantly clear. Jesus says, "But from the beginning, it was not so." And notice that Jesus doesn't say, "Well, in the beginning, it wasn't so." He says, "From the beginning." Jesus makes a sweeping statement in time that goes from the Garden of Eden up to the moment he's speaking. From the beginning, it was not so. And that covered the time period of the law of Moses. If anybody was misunderstanding that God approved all of that, Jesus says, it's not so. So it does indeed simplify things. It simplifies things to put the civil law in its proper perspective, removing what I at least believe is a misunderstanding of apoluo as a legal term. Writing of divorcement, that's the legal term. Removing what I think is our misunderstanding of apoluo as a legal term is an important simplification. It removes all those problems of who went to the courthouse first, who signed the papers first, and what was the formal reason written on the paper for the divorce. All of that has to do with the legal documentation, the legal divorce. Man defines what's on those pieces of paper. That's a cultural thing. Civil law is important. It must be followed. But there is a distinction between the apoluoing of the physical union and the legal writing that documents it. When Jesus speaks of the apoluoing, the putting away, he is speaking of the disruption of the physical union. And please note this vital point. Please note this necessary conclusion that follows from that. Understanding that charizoing and apoluoing are a distancing that makes it clear that once a relationship has been broken, once a relationship has been charizoed and the man and the woman have been apoluoed, once that has happened, it cannot happen again. If a man and a woman are apoluoed and their relationship charizoed in 1996, no matter who initiates the distancing, neither of them can come back in 1999 and apoluo their spouse. Once they're distanced, they're distanced. You can't redistance people who are already distanced. But let me point out that even if you believe that apoluo is this legal term, I hope I have presented at least some reason for you to think about that if that was your conclusion and reconsider that. But if you do decide that, no, apoluo is a legal term. Apoluo means the legal divorce. The same conclusion is true. A man and a woman who are legally divorced in 1996 cannot be again legally divorced in 1999. If somebody divorces his wife in 1996, she can't come back and divorce him in 1999. The judge is going to say, "But lady, you're already divorced." Either way you interpret that word apoluo, if Bill apoluos Jane for the wrong reasons in 1996, Jane cannot come back and apoluo Bill for the right reasons in 1999. Once they're apoluoed, they're both apoluoed. So, where are we? Having reconnected Jesus' words to the context of Genesis 2 and seen that it's the physical union that's in view here, and having reconciled Jesus' words in Matthew 19 with Paul's language in 1 Corinthians 7 to see that putting away, that charizoing the union is indeed possible, and that charizoing occurs when there is a distancing between those who are supposed to be joining themselves in a physical way, and having recognized the role of civil law, understanding that the apoluoing is distinct from the written divorcement, that in various ways, in various lands, in various cultures is taken care of by man, I would suggest that we are now prepared to reduce Jesus' words in Matthew 19:9 to simple English terms. It still seems to me the best way to understand Matthew 19:9 is just to follow the context of the verses that preceded. Verses 3 and 4 refer to the creation of a male and a female. Verses 5 and 6 refer to a physical joining between those two. And the last part of verse 6 is introduced the possibility of a putting asunder, of a charizoing of that physical joining. And then in verses 7 and 8, still talking about the same dissolution of that physical joining, Jesus uses the word apoluo. Jesus teaches in these verses that one who causes the distancing between spouses that disrupts their physical union, independent of any legal actions that may or may not occur, the person who introduces that distance has apoluoed the two, and he has charizoed their relationship. Now, I need to go and add one footnote to the discussion. There's one other point that I'd like for us to look at in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Having introduced or having noted that apoluo means putting a distance between in a physical sense, some might suggest, some have suggested, well, if that's the case, if apoluo does mean this physical distancing, why, wouldn't that mean that when the man goes down to the corner store to pick up a carton of milk, that he's apoluoed his wife because he's put a physical distance between them? And if the wife is at home committing adultery with another man, well, does that mean that he's already apoluoed his wife when the adultery occurs and therefore he could never marry anybody else? Well, I believe that Paul clearly explains that aspect of this situation in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 3 and 4. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 3 and 4, Paul says that a husband and a wife are to be sexually available to one another. And he commands in verse 5, defraud ye not one another, except it be with consent for a time. And the purpose there is to avoid temptation. Well, here is the principle. The physical relationship must be unavailable for any significant period only by mutual consent. If one goes to the store, one goes to work, one goes on a trip, that's fine. But if one partner in the relationship leaves his spouse or sends his spouse away, or if either party withholds himself from his spouse to the point that he causes temptation for the other, then that person has inappropriately distanced himself physically from his spouse. The critical point is not when the legal papers are signed at the courthouse. The critical point is when a person has apoluoed his spouse and charizoed the physical union that is supposed to be available to prevent temptation. Hence, in Matthew 5:32, which is a little bit different language here, in Matthew 5:32, Jesus says that the one who breaks the physical union, causes the distance so that it's no longer available, actually causes the infidelity of the other. Matthew 5:32, Jesus says, but I say to you that whoever shall put away, that's our Greek word apoluo, whoever shall put away his wife, saving for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery. And whoever shall marry her that is put away, or American Standard Version says, committeth adultery. They cause the adultery because they have not been the available spouse they should have been. And Jesus says, therefore, they have caused the adultery of the other spouse, and by this verse, Jesus says they are not permitted to have a future relationship. So with this understanding of Jesus' words from this context, what does Jesus say in Matthew 19:9? Jesus says, and I say unto you, whosoever shall put away, apoluo, his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, keeps on committing, the Greek present tense, adultery. And whoso marrieth her which is put away doth commit adultery. Jesus says that unless sexual unfaithfulness is the cause of the apoluoing, of the distancing, then any marriage of either party ever is an adulterous union. And note about the thing about the cause. Now we understand from science courses the laws of cause and effect. The cause has got to come before the effect. The cause has got to come before the result that results from the cause. In this context, in this passage, the result is the apoluoing. Therefore, the cause, the unfaithfulness, must come before the apoluoing. Let me say that again. In this passage, the result is the apoluoing, the put away. Therefore, the cause, the unfaithfulness, must come before the apoluoing. If two people are already apoluoed when the fornication occurs, then the grounds that Jesus stipulate here are not met for any future remarriage. I believe that Matthew 19:9 is just that simple. Jesus teaches that unless sexual unfaithfulness is a cause of, and therefore precedes the apoluoing, the distancing of the two people who are supposed to be available for a sexual union, then any marriage of either party ever is an adulterous joining. That, I believe, is Christ's simple teaching about marriage, divorce, and remarriage.